the end. Nope, this is just as good. Often I'll record something that I'm speaking. I'm not using the recording for anything. I'm going to get rid of the recording, but the timing is good. So here we have the evil eye. But I'm not going to retell the joke about Mr. Schwartz for the audio. We have this concept of it as something that you can trace anthropologically through different societies and say, well, this was in Europe and this was in the Middle East. We have a possible link to wet and dry, which I find fascinating, but I don't know how to match it to what we have now, except to say that what we do now may have grown from something and sort of spread beyond it. But is it a Jewish thing? Could someone actually make the argument that it starts in Jewish cultures and it actually spreads from there? Maybe we are guilty of giving the world the evil eye, or has the world given it to us? Is there anything you could think of, preferably before you look at the source sheet, within Judaism, within Torah, that would lead to us believing in the evil eye as a concept? Does this seem to have a Jewish anchor anywhere?
It seems to have more of an Israeli anchor. I'm sorry I don't know if that's the right term, if anyone here is. And my husband is my parents-in-law, and they're very big on it. But I hear more from Israelis from anyone else.
Interesting. I mean, that could be a modern phenomenon about communities. That doesn't necessarily come from. I mean, the truth of the matter... Well, I'll come back to the truth of the matter later. Take a look on your sheet. Let's start us off with source number 2. And what I believe is the first biblical use of the term evil eye. This is when Avram is supposed to evict Yishmael. Right? Sarah has told him, get rid of this child, he's not going to inherit, and so on. Vayera hadavar me'od be'enei Avraham al odos b'no. The matter regarding his son was evil in the eyes of Abraham. Now, that isn't the same as the phrase evil eye, right? It could just mean you judge something to be evil. The more explicit use comes up in Sefer Devarim, in source number 3. It's talking about the issue of Shemitah. Every 7 years, the land in Israel is supposed to be left fallow, but in addition to that, loans that are due before the Shemitah year are nullified. Well, technically it's not before the Shemitah year. The day when loans are nullified is actually Rosh Hashanah after Shemitah. So in other words, let's pretend that 5772, the year that we're now in, was a Shemitah year. It's not. But this coming Rosh Hashanah, at the end of 5772, would be when loans were nullified. And the way the law works is that any loan that is due before then is now void. Which means I will be uncomfortable extending a loan to somebody with a due date that's close to the end of the Shemitah year, lest that person not pay me back. And so the Torah warns, don't do that. We need loans. Without credit, the economies will collapse. That's the lesson of the last 5 years or so in the global economy. So take a look at the Torah's warning in source number 3. He shamer lecha, guard yourself. Lest there be an evil thought in your heart. The term Belial, Beli Al, worthless. Nothing positive, nothing elevated about it. Lest there be a negative thought in your heart, Lemor saying, Karvash Nas Hashavash Nas Hashemitah. The seventh year has come, the year of Shemitah. V'ra'ah Einecha Be'achicha Ha'evyon. And your eye will be evil. Right? Ayin hara. V'ra'a einecha. Your eye will be evil against your brother, the indigent, v'lo sitein lo, and you will not give him. So there, the phrase is the phrase ayin ra, an evil eye. So the phrase itself certainly has an anchor for us, and then another example of it in source number 4, later in Sefer Devarim, in the Tochacha. The Tochacha is the warning that we are given of the horrible things that will befall the Jewish people in the event that they don't follow the covenant they've made with Hashem. So look at the phrase, Ha'ish harach becha ve'anog me'od. It's talking about a time of starvation. And it says, the man among you who is soft, ve'anog me'od, and who is very pampered, te'ra eino, b'achiv u'be'eshes cheko u'v'yeser banav asher yosir, he will have an evil eye, teira eino, ra'ayin, against his brother and wife, his remaining children, he won't give them from his food, and so on. Looks like the phrase ayin hara, doesn't it? It seems like it to me. It's not just a coincidental turn of phrase. One more, and then we're going to come back to look at these collectively. On the second side, Al tilcham es lechem ra'ayin. Okay? Do not eat the bread. Tilcham is a funny verb. We usually think of the verb lamechet mem in terms of war, but here it means lechem is to break bread. So do not.
Shoresh, it's interesting. Tilcham lechem.
Yes, and milchama tends to be about lechem, doesn't it? I don't know of an etymological link between the two words. Could be there is one. I'm sure Shimshon HaFalhersh has something on that. But al tilcham es lechem ra'ayin. Don't eat the bread of a person who has an evil eye. What is the link? Is there a link between the various uses of evil eye in the four psukim we just offered? They're across time, in a sense. Meaning the first one, the one in source number two, is in the times of Abraham. The second and third that we brought are from Sefer Devarim at the end of the Jews' days in the wilderness. And then the last one is Mishle, from the time of Shlomo HaMelech. So it's possible for a phrase to change in what it's going to mean to the listener and to the speaker. But can we construct from these four sources a picture of what it means to have an evil eye?
Begrudging?
I'm sorry?
Kind of like begrudging, like not wanting to.
Right, someone who doesn't want to give, someone who doesn't want to provide. Certainly we would see that in source number three, right, on the sheet, the one about not wanting to extend the loan. You'd see it in number four, not wanting to share one's food. In number five also, the point is, don't eat the bread of somebody who really doesn't want to give you.
What's interesting, yeah. And I don't know if this probably doesn't answer your question, is that when we think of ayin hara net today, we think about the recipient. All these are talking about the person holding the evil eye. We sort of twist it around.
Right. Well, the recipient, yeah, so to speak, of the evil eye in these cases would be whom? In number two, there isn't. There isn't a recipient.
But at least the recipient in terms has to be a person showing off and in your face, and that's why he's getting the evil eyes. In a way, he's being this selfish.
But when we say Kinayinahar, like I'm 70 years old, Kinayinahar,
that's something else. So when someone is wealthy or showing off his wealth or has a million kids and we have 10,000 kids, they're kind of in your face. So that's why you say that. You may be getting Kinayinahar, someone else is suffering because he has something you have.
Right. But Elisa, take that point a step further. What would you do with that point about the different angle on it?
The recipient is vulnerable. Mm-hmm. More vulnerable than the person giving the evil eye, because the examples given are the poor person, the child and wife who maybe in that time period are dependent on the husband and father for the food.
That's true.
With Abraham, he's talking about his son. Like there's a status or a power differential.
Right. There's a power differential. That's exactly I think the phrase. You have someone who is powerful and someone who is powerless, or at least is not in as powerful a position. And ayin hara is from the direction of the person who is powerful towards the person who is in the weaker position. So Avraham finds the tactic evil, you know, in terms of what would be done to his son Yishmael. Now, I'm not sure, because it's really more targeted at the plan than it is at Yishmael. So I'm not sure how to do it in the Avraham case, in source number two. But in the other ones, the borrower is the weaker person. In source number four, it's the person who needs food. In source number five, it's the person also who's coming for food. It's very much about power, and it's also, and this goes back to the points that were made before, it's about being begrudging, unhappy to go along with something, like Abraham in his case, and it's about generosity. It's about, or you know, a lack thereof, not wanting to be generous. I actually didn't bring it on here, I think, because I brought other examples instead. But you remember the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos in the second parak, where they talk about the five students and what each one identified as a good trait that should be pursued, and what each one identified as a bad trait. And one of the good traits that's identified is Ayin Tova, right? And one of the bad traits that's identified is Ayin Ra, having a good eye positive, having a bad eye on others is a negative. One of the things that strikes me here, in its use in Tanakh, as well as in that Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, is that Ayin Hara is a rational concept. Right? I mean, when we are told here, don't manifest an evil eye towards someone, number one, as you pointed out, it's a human thing. You know, it's born by somebody, right? And number two, it's about a logical relationship. Yeah, the person who says, I don't want to do this for somebody else, we may not like that person's conduct, but there's a logic to it. It's not an unreasonable, out there thing. The feeling of, well, I don't want to extend a loan, because if I do, I'm going to lose my money. We may not like that attitude, but it's reasonable. Which leads me to then ask, how is putting a red string around your wrist going to protect you from it?
Well, today's manifestation may not be so rational.
Right.
We don't think of it as human. We think of it as something that's going to happen to us because of, like, some force. Yes.
I see just being on the opposite side of, like, the coin almost. On the one hand, you're in the upper hand. I have the upper hand. And on the other situation, we're on the lower hand. And I think it's almost like, we look at God as always having the upper hand. Or there's some spirit out there looking down, always has the upper hand, and we're the ones that we're afraid that it's going to be cheap with us. They're not going to give us what we need or what we want, or it's going to shorten the life or whatever. So
right.
Maybe it's just a flippant perspective.
Is Ayin Hara in opposition of God's will? I mean, can we think that it can honestly affect what Hashem's going to do for us? Or?
You tell me. Or was that question the answer to the question also? No, but what do you think? Do you think that someone could say, well, I don't want that person to benefit and therefore influence?
Well, we believe it for the good, right? We don't. We say to heal them for somebody to have a refuah. So
why is it different?
Well, I don't know. It's maybe because it's positive. And the other one is negative. I'm sorry to explain.
But why would that?
That's how you go about it. One is an action on my part. I'm actually doing tilling. You know, I'm saying tilling. I'm doing something. I'm changing myself. I'm turning to Hashem. I'm increasing, Hashem in the situation versus putting a string on my wrist, which is really pretty effortless and sort of almost relying on an object of,
Well, maybe it's not just relying on the object. Maybe it's a reminder for us. And it's just a symbol for us to say, just like you can go look at a wedding band and say, oh, I'm so lucky, I have my family and I have this. You know, it's a reminder. You can think of the good thing. You can look at the string and say, I can't just take life for granted. Like, it's there to keep us in check, as opposed to it's not the protecting. But we're now saying, I'm not going to take for granted. I'm not going to boast about what I have. I'm going to be appreciative of what I have.
Right. Now, keep in mind that doesn't require a red string, per se.
No, but maybe that's...
From Kevah Rachel or the Kotel or otherwise.
No, we're all talking about being the recipient. This is all talking about not having an evil eye. That's the difference that I'm really feeling. Because we're talking about the red string, we shouldn't receive an Ayin Hara. But all these things are talking about not looking at somebody in a bad way.
I mean, there's the idea that, like, Hashem treats us the way that we treat other people. So, like, if we judge people favorably, Hashem judges us favorably. Mm-hmm. That works before and the other way also. If you're going to be...
Right. Keep in mind that one of these was about being the recipient.
Eating the bread, right?
Number five.
Right. Don't eat the bread
of a person of an evil eye. Now, this is more common sense than, superstition. This is, if you know that somebody is stingy about things, then don't go into his house and have lunch there, knowing he's looking at you the whole time and measuring what you're eating. that's a sort of common sense statement, but it is about avoiding the impact of an evil eye. Now, what would the impact be? Maybe the impact is nothing. Or maybe the impact is this person is going to be bitter and upset, and he's going to use that anger to justify doing something to you in the future. He came to my house, and he ate all my food. So now I'm going to do X to him. It's worth noting that there is the defensive one here. Let's try to refine our understanding a little bit of what we're talking about. We see here, within this evil eye, at least I think I see and I think I'm hearing here, that it is a person's desire to at least not benefit another, and potentially even to harm another. Right, that's like the case of the person who doesn't want to extend the loan. Take a look at source number 6. Mishnah and Pirkei Avos. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Rabbi Yeshua taught, Ayin hara v'yetzer hara v'sinas habrios motzien es ha'adam min ha'olam. Three things remove a person from this world. Evil eye, evil desire, and hatred of others. It's a very interesting set. Is this being a victim of an evil eye, or is this being someone who wields an evil eye? I think out of consistency with the rest of the Mishnah, right? The other two items are clearly about the actor, not the acted upon. So I think it's saying that having an evil eye removes a person from this world. Now, there's another Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says, Kina, Taiva, and Kavod. Remove a person from this world, right? The jealousy of others, desire, and a thirst for honor remove a person from this world. So that what we're talking about is traits which will, in the end, harm the bearer. An evil eye now is bad for the bearer, not just for the victim. So how does the Rambam explain Ayin Hara here? Take a look at source number 7, the Rambam's comment on that Mishnah. He says, Chemdas hamamon, v'rov hata'ava, v'ro'a hanefesh. Desire for money, excess of desire in general, and in general, when you see the word ta'ava, it's assumed it's about immorality, and ro'a hanefesh, and an evil spirit. Can we establish which one of these is Ayin Hara in the three that he's commenting on? It would seem to be look how we did it. Chemdas hamamon, desire for wealth, is Ayin Hara. That's the way, it's one-to-one. So Ayin Hara is Chemdas Hamamon, desire for wealth. Yetzer Hara is Rova Taiva, excess of desire. Sinas Habriyos, hatred of others, is Roa Hanefesh, an evil spirit. What I'm seeing here in the Rambam is that Ayin Hara is specifically financial. Chemdas Hamamon. The Rambam understands this to be Ayin Hara to be about desire for wealth. Very consistent with what we saw in source number 3 about not wanting to extend a loan, what we saw in source number 4 about not wanting to give away one's food to others, and source number 5, not wanting to give away one's food to others. What we do with Abraham's case, I think, is more challenging. I think it can be fit in. Maybe we'll come back to it. But the issue here seems to be about financial. It's a financial jealousy. It's a stinginess. It's a not wanting to share what one has with others. That is what we're talking about when we talk about Ayin Hara. Follow? Mm-hmm. Yes?
So what about all the rest of it, do you think? Or did it all get added on? Like, other, like pregnancy, there's also another thing, unless I just don't understand. I haven't been observant. Like, if you ask someone, or maybe you're not supposed to have any children you have, and naming the children instead of saying how many, I think that might be
right.
And other things, I can think of many examples. Do you think that just all got added on or mixed up, or people created it on their own?
So that's what we have to get to. I'm not sure we're going to answer that today, but let's see what happens. It's fundamentally a good question. I think there's a very interesting manifestation of this in source number 8. source number 8 is also Pirkei Avot. And here it's contrasting the followers of Avraham and the followers of Bilam. Bilam, remember, is the prophet slash sorcerer who's hired to curse the Jews when they're about to enter Canaan, hired by the conglomerate of Midian and Moab because they feel like military strength just isn't going to cut it against the Jews, so we're going to try to curse them instead. And the Mishnah there says, in source number 8, Ayin ra'a v'ruach gavoha v'nefesh rechava mitamidav shal Bilam harasha. One who has an evil eye, a haughty spirit, and a broad, I rendered in brackets, complacent soul, is of the students of wicked Bilam. That word complacent came from a friend who recommended that as a translation on Nefesh Rechava. It means someone who is very self-satisfied. That's what we're talking about. And that's what it means to be a student of Bilam. Now, we could talk about the haughty spirit or the complacency, but the main focus I want to bring here is the evil eye that's associated with Bilam. Bilam is all about vision. When you look at Parshas Balak, Bilam is described as Sum Ha'ayin, the person of either the open eye or the sealed eye in the Parsha. He goes to look at the Jews in order to be able to utter his curses. And what Bilam is trying to do to the Jews is fundamentally about money. And this really requires a chumash in front of you, which we don't all have, so I'm going to just explain it what I mean outside the text. When Moab and Midian hire Bilam to curse the Jews, what are they afraid of? What motivates them?
So they just come and eat all their crops and do all, eat, right? Like, you take their livestock and everything.
They were just at war.
They just seen that the Israel had fought against another nation.
Right, so the Jews did indeed in Parshas Chukas fight against the Kanani, whether the Kanani are really Amalek or not. But they saw the Jews fight against the Kanani, and they're scared. But it doesn't seem to be a military fear when you actually open up Parshas Balak. Because the way the Parsha begins is them going to Bilam and saying, we want to hire you. But the phrase as it goes there is, Hine Am Yatsami Mitzrayim, a nation left Egypt, Vayachas Es Ein Haaretz, they covered the eye of the land, Ata Kavali Oso, now please curse them. It's the way that the Jews cover the land. And the Jews are described there in the beginning of the Parsha as Kilachol Atayilachachu Akahalas Kal Sevivo Seinu. Now, this nation is going to lick up everything around us. Kilachol Hashor Es Yerek Hasadeh. The way an ox licks up the grass in the field. And as Rashi explains there, that when an ox starts to eat, nothing is left. The ox just eats everything down to the ground. In other words, their concern is not a military concern. It's not the Jews are going to fight against us. Perhaps they even know that the Jews have been instructed. You're not allowed to fight a war against Moab. Rather, it's Jews are moving into the neighborhood and they're going to use all of our resources. It's about wealth. And so Bilam is the agent of this Ayin Ra, this evil eye, that says we better curse these Jews, because otherwise they're going to take all of our assets. That's the idea, it seems, within this. Now, take a step back, because this goes back to the question of, but can somebody actually do that to somebody else? So let's say you have a stingy eye towards somebody else. Why is that going to affect them? Who says that that's going to affect them at all? So, take a look at source number 9. Kol hamoser din al chavero hu nanash techila. If a person passes judgment on somebody else, that person is going to be punished first. Okay? Meaning, if I turn to God and I say, so-and-so did something wrong, yeah, you should punish him. The punishment would be mine before it would come to that person. Not the punishment for his sins, but the punishment for my own. I don't want to say this about myself, Einhard. But the idea is that if Reuven says about Shimon, safe to use Reuven and Shimon out of women's class, if Reuven says, you know, Shimon is a horrible person, Shimon lies, I don't understand how he's getting away with it, God should really do something to Shimon, then that inspires Hashem to say, well, Reuven, what do you have on your record? You know, let me see what you have, and perhaps it's time to punish you for what you've been doing. That's the concept here, and they give an example in which Sarai complains to Abraham about Hagar. Vatamar Sarai el Avram chamasi alecha. Sarah says to Abraham, I didn't translate this in the English because I was cramming in space here, but Sarah says, I'm really angry about what Hagar is doing. And the next step is the eulogy for Sarah by Abba Avraham Lispodla Sarah Valiv Kosan. The suggestion that the Gemara is making is that Sarah gets zapped because of what she said about Hagar. Now, there are some interesting nuances there, and I don't want to go that route with this right now. I mean, that's something that's worthy of its own conversation of what happened with Sarah and Hagar, and the fact that these two things are not side by side within the Torah. Plus, we have other discussions about Sarah and her death. But the point here is the concept, in general, that it might be meaningful when a person passes judgment on another. It's potent enough that it gets Hashem upset. Right? It's not simply, I'm angry about somebody else, I don't want somebody else to have. It's an action that has repercussions. If you take a look at source number 10, you see a more explicit reference to it. Amar Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, Kol makom shenasnu chachamim einehem, o misa, o oni. Wherever the sages turned their eyes is either death or poverty. Meaning turn their eyes in a negative way. That the chachamim have the ability to actually harm someone. They could say something, they could pass judgment on something and actually cause negative repercussions. And there are other sources like this. I could have brought a few more. But you get what we're saying here. There is the possibility. How does that work? It seems to be tefillah. It seems to be prayer. I mean, it's sort of a perverse prayer, but it's somebody saying, I want so-and-so to be punished. That's what Ayin Hara is.
So it's not a thought. It has to be an intention. Or say a thought. Any thought can come, you know, which a person might regret 2 seconds later. You know, that shouldn't be the same as
that's
a prayer,
a good question.
Right?
That's a really good question. I wonder. The reason I wonder is because of a pasuk regarding a needy person. Where the Torah talks about, it's in Parashas Mishpatim. Do you have a Chumash? Shmos, it's Chaf Aleph. If you just have a Chumash Shmos, that'll be fine. Talking about someone who doesn't give to the needy. When someone is in a position of need and others don't give to him, and it says, V'kara alecha el Hashem, v'haya b'chachet. He will call against you to God, and there will be a sin upon you because you didn't give, because you didn't help. And the commentators there, thank you very much, the commentators there suggest that even if he doesn't call, the person will still be punished. If I can find it quickly in here, I'll read it out. The one here is slightly different, but it also serves my purposes. Kol amanavi asom lo se'anun, you shall not oppress a widow or an orphan. Imane se'anei oso, and if you do, ki im tsa'o ki tsa'ak elai shamoa eshma tsa'aka, so when that person cries out to me, I am going to hear that person's cries. Hashem says, I'm going to hear when that person is hurt. And we say it's not just about if they call out, but even just causing them that pain is already sufficient for Hashem to say, I'm going to act on their behalf. So that we would say it isn't just about an explicit prayer, but if I do something that causes, you know, someone else to suffer, then I'm already, so to speak, asking for Ayin Hara. So what we've established this week is that, you know, we have on the one hand this sort of anthropological theory of the spread of Ayinhara that we read about in source number one, but we find it within Jewish sources. We find it associated with a begrudging approach to others, a desire not to give to others, and it basically seems to be a person's desire to harm another, perhaps out of selfishness, perhaps out of a desire for money, and it does seem to be very financially focused, but it translates into what may be as explicit as Moser din al chavero, turning to God and saying, why don't you punish so-and-so? Or may even be as subtle as simply a feeling of being wounded. And that may be sufficient to already trigger what we're calling ayin hara. Now, what we haven't yet addressed is, so how do you protect yourself from it, number one? We still haven't addressed the question of how did this become the much broader ayin hara concept that we hear about today. So we still have a lot to do. But it's 10 o'clock, so I'm going to call it here, and we'll have to pick up with that, God willing, next time.